Dinner for Two is brought to you by Vista. If you're a small business owner, entrepreneur, or have a creative idea, Vista will help you bring your vision to life. Through their professional design solutions and services and high-quality marketing products, you can build a brand you can be proud of. Visit vistaprint.com.au to start creating.
Hi, I'm Elise Tran, and welcome to Dinner for Two, presented by Pop Sugar Australia. Today, I wanted to talk about leadership. Being a good leader comes up when you're running any organisation, whether that be from your household to a sports team to a small business. At TDE, and even in my current roles, I've had to make very unpopular decisions as a leader, whether that be changing shipping rates to the annoyance of customers, discontinuing a product, and decisions around management and promotion of my team members. I found that deciding who would be promoted, who got to go overseas, who got to go on the fun shoot, really difficult. And even growing the business fast enough to meet the career expectations of my team members was a really hard one too. I guess a leader can't always be popular, and sometimes it can be a bit lonely as a result. Now, in thinking about how to be a better leader, who better to speak to than one of the most amazing leaders in Australian history? The Honourable Julie Bishop. So I know you've told this story a million times, but can you give us a snapshot on how your career started?
My strongest subjects at school were English and the humanities, and that made law one of the logical career options. And so I kind of just went into law school. But in recent times, I've been thinking about my mother, who died a number of years ago. And I recall that she had a very close school friend who went on to have a trailblazing career as a female lawyer in Adelaide. And in retrospect, I think my mother subliminally was guiding me towards law because she so admired this friend of hers who went on to become a judge in South Australia. So I fell in love with law, how the courts worked, how lawyers worked, and had a great career as a lawyer. So that's how my legal career started, and I ended up spending 20 years in the law.
Segue into that politics thing, how did that sort of all come about?
Well, interestingly, I took a sabbatical during my partnership as a lawyer and went to Harvard Business School. And it was while I was there in 1996, a lecturer challenged the class of senior managers on this Harvard Business School course to consider public office as a way of contributing to your community. Virtually everyone in the class was, on the corporate ladder. And suddenly I had this eureka moment that I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be part of the national debates on national issues. And you've got to be careful what you wish for, because within 2 years of returning from Harvard, I was the elected federal member for the seat of Curtin here in Western Australia. But again, in retrospect, I think my mother did have an influence there, or my family, because they were very involved in local politics. My mother was a local councillor, the local mayor. My father was involved in apple industry politics. So maybe public service was something that I'd been brought up to believe was a calling that was worth putting your energy and effort into.
Did you have politics as a side hustle to your managing partnership, or was it like, how did you roll out of that?
No, I didn't. Interestingly, I wasn't involved in student politics at uni, like I wasn't a young lib or anything. Well, I was involved in law school politics. I made myself the secretary of the Law Students Society, but that was so I could organise the annual ball and the annual dinner. But I was always interested in the legislative process. I was a litigation lawyer, so I was fascinated with how legislation impacted on then my clients. And so it was probably a natural progression to become involved in politics as, parliaments make the laws. And instead of being an interpreter of legislation, I became a legislator.
Because I can imagine it. You're, a powerful partner at Clay Newt's, amazing, wearing all the power suits. And then do you just pick up the phone and call someone and be like, hey, I want to play in this politics game?
It was a little more complex than that. I had to find a seat, and in Western Australia at that time there were only 15 federal seats, but it was a chance and an opportunity that I couldn't miss, because in the seat where I lived and worked, Curtin, in the western suburbs of Perth, the sitting member was in fact an independent. So by the time I came to focus on a federal political career, I thought, I can win this back for the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party were of the view that the seat could not be won, but I got my own research done that showed that it could be won if you adopted a particular strategy, which I obviously did. and won the seat.
I love the chutzpah. Now with your new career, university leadership.
Yes.
Why did you choose that out of everything available to you, which would have been anything and everything?
When I left politics, I decided that, okay, I've had 20 years in the law, 20 years in politics. Now I want 20 years at least in the private sector. But I could now choose what I wanted to do and when I wanted to do it. And I was always fascinated with education and how higher education could impact on young people and make such a transformation in their lives. And I'd served as the education minister in the Howard government. And then when I was foreign minister, I introduced the new Colombo plan, which was a way of giving Australian undergraduates an opportunity to live and study overseas, because I thought it was so important to have Australian students lift their sights beyond just university in Australia, but actually live, study, work overseas, make them a much more rounded person. So it was always a great interest of mine. And when I left politics and ANU contacted me and asked if I would consider being Chancellor of Australian National University, I jumped at it. An opportunity to shape the direction of the university and through that higher education, it was just a long-standing passion.
Did the young Julie always think she was going to be a leader?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I have two older sisters and a younger brother. And maybe it was because my parents practiced on the first two. So by the time they got to me, they pretty much left me to my own devices. But I always did what I wanted to do. I was pretty headstrong about things. And yeah, I often took leadership roles. If they weren't given to me, I took them. I think that's fair enough to say, like whether I was the head of the Brownies or the netball team or whatever it was, I was always in there organising people and coming up with ideas and getting people to follow me. I was head girl at my school. I think the headmistress said to my mother at the time, it was a question of if you can't beat her, you have to join her. I don't know that I would have been the teacher's first choice of.
Were you the popular cool girl?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, love that.
I don't think the academic staff at the school would have chosen me. But as Miss Pike said, if you can't beat her, you've got to join her. So they made me head girl, which was a lot of fun. I think that it comes with a self-confidence about your judgment, your intuition, just thinking, yeah, I can do this. I've got this.
So, and you know what is so amazing about that is that, you know, I think from an early age, you're clearly so sure of yourself. That's not the same for everyone. People listening might be like, oh God, what if I'm not feeling that sure about myself? And
yes,
how did you know that you were doing the right thing and that being in law for even that period of time was the right thing?
Yeah. Well, I know I'm in the right career when I wake up in the morning full of enthusiasm and I can't wait to get to work. And that applied to my work in the law. But it wasn't always a straightforward linear path. There were times when I had to leave a firm because it wasn't working out for me. I would go into a different area of law. I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie, so I have to be excited about what I'm doing and passionate about it. And so if it wasn't happening for me, I would move into an area and make it happen. And then most certainly in politics, that applied most days in politics when I couldn't wait to get up and start the day. And it happened every day that I was foreign minister.
Amazing.
It was such an honour, such a buzz to be foreign minister and represent Australia on the world stage. I loved every moment of that.
I love my work too and I really enjoy it. I don't really consider it work. Do you think that's where you have to be in order to excel and enjoy your work?
I think it helps. I mean, people ask me, how do you succeed? Well, there's no silver bullet. It's hard work, it's focus, it's dedication, it's attention to detail. These are all the key factors. But you have to be passionate about what you're doing. I couldn't be in a job where it was ho-hum. I've got to be mad about the subject matter. And that's what works for me. It might not work for everyone, of course.
I guess that is how you've gotten to the top of your game. And so if we're on that kind of stream, you get to the top of your game in any industry, you're going to cop some criticism.
Oh, yeah.
I know you're not, you know, immune to that. But how have you kind of dealt with that in the past?
It is tough. And when I started taking on more public roles, and this was back way back in the law when I became the first female managing partner of a big firm in Perth, and there was some criticism about it. I couldn't for the life of me work it out. People are jealous. People have their own agendas. People are, you know, projecting onto you their own disappointment. And I guess over time, particularly in politics, I learned to differentiate between criticism that, you know, it comes down to the nature of the criticism, constructive criticism is something I'm happy to consider. And, you know, I use it to potentially improve what I'm doing or improve my performance. But, you know, personal or nasty or just plain mean criticism, I can ignore it. And if it's from a, you know, a social media source, I don't read it. And if it's for somebody, from somebody whose opinion doesn't matter or for whom I have no respect, I don't read their opinions.
For me, I've always been able to turn to my peers. For you at the top, do you speak to anyone? Do you get to call someone? Do you call Obama? Like, what's the deal?
Not quite. Look, of course, most people need a support network, and I certainly have a group of friends and family in whom I can confide. I think you have to have mentors and people in your life that you can count on who have your back and don't have an agenda that's against your interests. And sometimes it can be pretty heartbreaking to find out that, you know, people that you thought were your friends are actually working against you. And believe me, in politics, you learn that every single day. So it's a pretty tough school, I tell you. But I contact people. I seek out views and ideas, particularly from people whom I respect. And that can be friends, family, or work colleagues.
Yeah, I was going to ask, who do you admire, maybe as a leader or even in general?
Well, I admire leaders with long-term vision, you know, those who understand the full implications of their decisions, intended or unintended, you know, people who can see beyond the everyday, the mundane. I guess in business, a very close friend and somebody who I find inspirational is Kerry Stokes.
Impressive empire.
Yeah, self-made. He's contributed greatly to Australia by, you know, creating thousands of jobs. He's an amazing philanthropist and he's a patron of so many organisations. So I really admire his life story. In politics, I always admired the way that former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice engaged in really principled and tough diplomacy while maintaining incredible style and dignity. She is extraordinary.
You guys are very similar.
Oh, that is a huge compliment.
What things have you kind of had to sacrifice?
I think the most precious thing is time. And I guess the greatest sacrifice I made in politics was time with my family and friends, particularly when I was foreign minister. It was all consuming. I was away all the time somewhere around the world and as deputy leader somewhere across Australia. So, you know, you try to be in contact as often as possible, but it's not easy. And now that I've been back in Perth, essentially for the last 18 months, I've reconnected with a lot of friends, and it's so important to have people around you that you can have fun with and spend time with. So I think that in terms of a sacrifice, it was the time that I didn't spend with people who meant a lot to me.
Dinner for Two is brought to you by Vista. If you're a small business owner, entrepreneur, or have a creative idea, Vista will help you bring your vision to life. Through their professional design solutions and services and high-quality marketing products, you can build a brand you can be proud of. Visit vistaprint.com.au to start creating.
You've always managed little teams, not little teams, big teams, little teams, little team now. I love that you've got some people that you've been working with for a number of years still with you.
That's right. I've got a team. Julie Bisham and Partners is four people. Me, Murray, who was my chief of staff and media advisor for about 16 years. Kirsten, who's been my EA since 2008. Mm-hmm. And then Lisa Holly. Lisa, she's my senior advisor and she comes out of the banking industry. She was with Bankwest for about 12 years. So yeah, I've got a little team, which is great.
That's like a walk in the park for you. There's nothing hard about that at all, is there?
Well, I think there's still the focus on individual needs. I think leading a team is important in that you have to focus on what each member of that team needs, what makes them focused on the outcomes that you want to achieve. You know, everybody's got to be equally committed to what we're striving to achieve. I talked earlier about going to Harvard Business School, which was a very expensive course, I must say, but I did take away one line from it, and that was, if you look after your people, the bottom line looks after itself. And that was essentially the core of it all. So it does take time and effort to build a culture in a team, whatever size the team is. And I think one of my greatest strengths, if I can self-reflect for a while, is that I treat people equally and I seek input from the most junior staff to the most senior staff, because all perspectives can be valuable. In my ministerial office, in my foreign minister's office, I had 5,000 people in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade around the world. But in my immediate ministerial office, I'd have a morning meeting whenever we were sitting in Parliament, and everybody came to the meeting from the person at the front desk through to the most senior chief of staff. And I would seek input from all of them, because the person at the front desk was the one that took the calls, saw the people coming in, sat there while they were sitting in the waiting room, and you know, their perspective on what I was or wasn't doing was as important to me as, you know, the most senior expert advisor. So I think that helps build a team culture.
For sure. Do you think you'd ever be a junior member in a team, or do you think you'll always be a leader?
That's hard to say. I'm trying to think of a team where I'd be a junior member, but yeah, it's a nice thought.
Not junior, but not be the.
I tend to be invited to join teams as the leader these days. So that would be hard. But hey, it's not beyond a realm of possibility to join a team and be one of the junior woodchucks.
the junior woodchucks at this major, I was thinking some like diabolical, like global team of people that are going to combat climate change massively.
No, I'd want to lead that too.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't want to just be a voice on that.
Part of the leadership
team. Yeah. So then, Julie, what do you think your leadership style is?
Well, as foreign minister and indeed as a parliamentarian, I had the opportunity to observe leaders up close and personal, different leadership styles. And I really believe that there is a significant difference between male and female leadership characteristics. I'm not saying that, you know, all men exhibit the same characteristics and all women exhibit the same. And yet there is a profound difference between the way men and women do lead. One lesson I did learn is that the most assertive person in the room isn't necessarily the best leader. And I noted this as foreign minister with the male foreign ministers would be very assertive, bordering on aggressive. They would have very little empathy. If they were building a team, they were setting goals for the team and then holding everyone to account. Whereas women were much more empathetic, much more focused on the individual, much more focused on what each person needed to fulfill their ambition.
It comes back to that Harvard line.
Yeah, very much. And so male-female leadership is quite different. It doesn't mean one is better than the other. It means that you need a mix of those different styles around the decision-making forums, whether it's the, you know, UN Security Council or the National Cabinet here in Australia or boardrooms. You need a diversity of views, perspectives, ideas, not just gender diversity, although that's the most obvious one. And I've always found that the more diverse the decision-making forum in terms of the makeup of the members, the better outcomes you get, the better discussions, the better outcomes. But I did see male and female leadership in quite distinct categories. I remember once at the UN Security Council in about 2016, there were about 150 foreign ministers from different nations, and about 20 of them were female. And I attended a meeting one day with all male foreign ministers and me, and we were talking about anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism, and what was happening in Syria. And it was the most aggressive, testosterone-filled debate I've ever been involved with, a lot of shouting and yelling and people pushing their perspective, and there were just no outcomes, no results. That night, as it turned out, I attended a meeting of all of the female foreign ministers, and there were only about 20 there. Same topic, same discussion, counter-terrorism, Syria, what were we going to do? The discussion was so much more collaborative, so much more in search of consensus. Now, one might say the female meeting was more constructive than the male. Not necessarily, but I thought, wow, if only we could have joined these two groups together, it would have been a fantastic debate.
So in distilling how, like for me, right, I've only, say, been leading for, let's call it like 7 or so years. And for me, I feel like I'm still kind of developing. You've talked about the difference between male and female leaders there, but then how do you kind of distill out some traits that, you know, how to be just more well-rounded?
Don't let others define who you are. Don't let other people define what you can achieve. Have the confidence to set your own goals and your own standards and then work hard to achieve them. there are so many people out there who will set for you standards or goals that they wouldn't or couldn't meet themselves. And I think that's a lesson for leaders. Don't let others define who you are. You define your leadership style and who you want to be. Don't live up to other people's expectations because they're not necessarily in your best interests. Also, you've got to back your intuition. You know what's right and wrong. You know what's good for you and what's not good for you. So back your judgment. Have mentors. Have people whose opinions you trust and run ideas past them because, you know, you said earlier it can be lonely at the top. Absolutely. You need people around you to bounce ideas off, and doesn't mean you have to accept what they say, but it's just good to test your theories and your ideas. And, you know, it's always good to have an evidence base for the decisions you're about to make. Otherwise, you know, yes, you're taking risk. Hopefully it's a calculated risk, but if there's no evidence to back your belief that you're going to get a particular outcome, that can be tough. So I'm a great believer in having, you know, what's the evidence that's going to give me the confidence that my decision will lead to a particular outcome.
And I thought what you said earlier about taking into account everyone's, you know, ideas and opinions and things in your team was a good one. Love to take that away with me. But is that one of the mechanisms that you do naturally that keeps your team engaged? You know, like, it's all about, for me, engagement, right? If someone, like we have talked about, enjoys their job, is engaged, they will generally perform well. Do you have any other...
Absolutely. I think everybody's got to be connected. Everybody wants to connect with the leader as well. Mm. And so I always found that the time I would spend one-on-one or in a group would pay enormous benefits. People want to tap into your thinking. They want to be inspired by you as the leader. I mean, that's why you're there. They're looking for direction from you. And don't let it be draining. Just make it part of what you do every day to keep everybody, you know, heading in the same direction.
I love being friends with my employees. I've run into some issues because of that.
Yes.
I love to, you know, have a drink with them or take them somewhere with me or take them to an event or whatever it
is. But there's still a line, Elise. Yeah. There's still a line where you're the one. The buck stops with you.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, you're the one that's got to make decisions, and some of them can be hard decisions that will affect negatively the people that you've made your friends.
Totally.
So even though, you know, you go out for a drink with them and everything, you still have to remember that at the end of the day, you're calling the shots and the buck stops with you.
I know. It's that difficult thing, you know, being that female leader who is empathetic, who is taking into account her team's, you know, needs, wants, engaging them, and then having to be hard line sometimes.
And And having to set a standard and expecting them to live up to it. But I think that's important too. People have to know where they stand. And so being able to articulate your values or expectations then saves a lot of heartache, because if people don't meet them, then it's easier to say, look, you know, either professionally develop them or develop them out of your team.
Right now there's the great resignation, and I see this in the AFR at the bottom of the homepage every day almost. How am I going to navigate the great resignation? How, you know, if you were in, you know, at the university, is there a brain drain? What's happening? How do we...
It's been very difficult at ANU and in higher education generally, because we were not able to access JobKeeper. So there were moments during 2020 in particular where we had to say goodbye to a lot of staff and people who'd been at the university for a very long time. It was tough. And so they call it separations. So we had many separations that were, you know, pretty difficult for people to take because we couldn't keep them on. The impact on our bottom line through, you know, the restrictions imposed by COVID was pretty devastating. But now we're back focused on, you know, rebuilding the university after COVID, and things are working out pretty well. But yeah, I still feel for people who, as a result of COVID, have lost their jobs. In fact, on the way here, I was listening to the jobless numbers have gone up in recent times. It's now those looking for a job is about 5.2%.
I read like conflicting headlines, because I open the SMH and it says something like unemployment rates are up, and then I open the AFR and it's like more jobs in New South Wales. So, you know, it's very...
Yeah, it's a question of long-term unemployed as well. I think that's the challenge. But no, it's difficult times. Oh, hang on. That's my alarm telling me I've got to head off for my next meeting.
This is a leader.
I use my alarm all the time, and it basically says to everybody, I have to go.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I know your buzzer has just gone, so thank you for coming on Dinner for Two.
Elise, it's been a pleasure. Love spending time with you.
loved speaking to Julie just now and loved how that buzzer went off. Like, I'm definitely going to use that technique in the future. Good way to tell someone a meeting's over. Anyway, so some takeaways from that. Don't let others define you. I feel like I do that all the time, so I'm definitely going to take that away with me. It is hard, you know, when people perceive you in a certain way, but it is a good reminder to run with your dream, run with what you think is best. The other point she made was it is important to engage with everyone in your team. Everyone has a new and fresh perspective and is totally worth taking into account. The third point I thought was just, you know, another great one to remember is to have some good people around you that you can bounce ideas off. It doesn't have to be, you know, other business owners or anything like that if you're so inclined, or colleagues. It can just be people you admire and trust, and it can just be your family. Thanks so much for joining us for Dinner for Two. I'm Elise Tran.
Dinner for Two is brought to you by Vista. If you're a small business owner, entrepreneur, or have a creative idea, Vista will help you bring your vision to life. Through their professional design solutions and services and high-quality marketing products, you can build a brand you can be proud of. Visit vistaprint.com.au to start creating.